and welcome to this week's House of Comments podcast. It is our 75th House of Comments, and more importantly, or equally importantly, we have now done more in this new run of House of Comments podcast than we've done in the original run. So we're now the proper version. We are Star Trek The Next Generation with the many series they had, rather than the original wooden version.
Is the plural of series is?
Leave me alone. Grammar Nazi. I'm delighted, as you can hear, to be joined by Mark Thompson, who's my regular co-host, who is the editor of the Mark Thompson blog, a Liberal Democrat supporting blog, and also to be joined by Nick Dennis, who is co-editor of the Conservative supporting blog Platform 10. Hi, Nick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you, and thank you for not picking me up on my language.
I think it's a Serie I. I don't know, anyway.
God knows.
That sounds like a baddie from Star Trek, actually, doesn't it?
So, I think
we should move on to the politics, shouldn't we, really?
Probably a good idea. And there's been a fair bit of politics this week. We started the week with the lobbying bill being discussed in Parliament on its second reading. Quite a contentious bill, known also as the gagging bill. Not popular with pretty much anybody except the government parties, and even several members of them not entirely keen. Mark, what do you think of this?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest, I'm not massively up on the detail, but from what I've read, it doesn't look at the moment like it's the sort of thing I'd be happy to support. Let's put it this way. It seems to be pretty loosely drafted, and there's a real risk at the moment that it would draw in all kinds of people and organisations and charities. It actually feels like if it was to just be legislated as is right now, there would be a real chilling effect, because I think it's so vague and woolly that a lot of people and organisations would just be worried that they would be included and would probably start self-censoring and not do the kind of political stuff that they might have wanted to do previously. Or if they did do it, then they'd kind of tone it down a lot and not spend that much money on it just because they'd be afraid of breaking these rules. So I certainly hope that what eventually gets legislated on isn't what we've seen so far. But, I mean, it's now gone to committee stage, hasn't it? And I know there's quite a lot of people in the Lib Dems who aren't happy with it, are willing to wait and see what happens in committee, because that's really where these kind of problems are supposed to be ironed out. So I'm not sure this is the end of the story yet.
And Nick, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, and I have to hold in my anger here, being a complete political geek and respecting the parliamentary process, I can't believe a bill this badly drafted has actually made it this far. I mean, as Mark said, I think the government did do some deals behind closed doors and admitted there are big problems and said, look, we're going to do something about some committee stage. And I think Andrew Lansley himself, who's the minister leading this bill, has already put 33 or 34 amendments in himself.
Oh, lucky
Lansley. Indeed. But that's basically like the person that he's admitting that it didn't come to Parliament in the state that it should have done. So hopefully by the end of this process, we'll have something good. But I mean, what's really, really I find perplexing about this is it's all hurried and rushed. And of course, hurried and rushed legislation tends to be bad legislation. But the actual scandal that forced this to be hurried and rushed wasn't a lobbying scandal. It was a journalist trying to get preferment from a politician for money. There was no lobbying. There was no lobbyist involved.
No, it was a fake lobbyist.
It was a fake lobbyist. I mean, and you know, lobbying, there is certain issues around lobbying that, you know, should be looked at, of course. But actually, the lobbying scandal, as it's been called, there was not one single lobbyist involved, as far as I could tell.
Certainly in that one. And what's equally interesting is that the lobbying scandal that came before that, which was the News of the World lobbyist, that lobbyist worked directly for the News of the World and therefore would not be caught up by this bill.
I mean, this is one of the, this is like the third part of the trilogy, post expenses, setting up the Parliamentary Standards Authority, which is a complicated bureaucratic way of sorting out expenses. Then the press regulation idea of Royal Charter, and now this is politicians legislating about stuff that affects them, not really seem to be doing a very good job, I think.
Yeah, I think that's perfectly true. I mean, I think there are real issues with each part of the bill. The most contentious is part two, which is the part that both reduces the amount of money any third party can spend and also massively widens what that money entails, so includes staff costs and overheads.
Is that the bit that's reduced from nearly a million, like 975,000, down to about 300 and something thousand?
Yeah. Which means that if you're a large organisation, you know, all your staff costs quite possibly do come to that kind of money. You know, I imagine that, for example, the National Housing Federation would be spending that kind of money in a year, in terms of they run 4 or 5 offices, they have a lot of staff, and they, you know, try to affect legislation. If they're trying to affect legislation, they're trying to convince parties to take up their suggestions, or they will tell parties their suggestions are wrong. And given the way that the bill is drafted, they will be told that even if they're not specifically going out and saying vote for X party because we agree with their with what they're saying on housing, if it could be considered to have had an effect, they'll be caught by the bill.
I mean, this is the mad thing about the original drafting. Is if I, let's say, my organisation spent £300,000 promoting, let's say, all newspapers should be printed on green paper, and then a politician said, yes, this is a brilliant campaign, I'm going to support it. Suddenly, even though I have had no contact with this politician, because this politician has taken on what I've been saying, automatically I come under the definition, which is mad.
Yeah, that is crazy. I mean, I think you've got a situation where Guido Fawkes, 38 Degrees, Unlock Democracy, and a whole host of charities all agree that something is a bad thing. I wouldn't necessarily agree with all of those individuals or organisations all of the time, but when they're all against something, it really does make you sit up and take notice. Or tit up and take notice, aren't you?
I won't pull you up on your language, then. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we should need to go on, because it sounds like we're all very much on the same page. But the other thing that you two may be more in unison together, as it were, than myself, is the fact that it's very specifically aimed at unions, whilst not looking at corporate money that goes into funding political parties. And you can have your disagreements with unions. God knows I've had mine. But I don't think the best way to win those disagreements is to legislate to shut them up.
Mm. Although there were some very interesting comments the other day. I forget who made them now. Oh, it was John Denham. He said that the kind of changes that the current government want to make to clip the wings of the unions and to basically try and restrict the funding that can end up with the Labour Party go through, then as far as he's concerned, all bets are off. And if Labour get in, then they'll bring in a funding cap of, you know, for individual donations. Mm. And because I think historically there's always been this feeling that you need to get a cross-party agreement. And because the Tories have traditionally not budged on a cap, and because Labour have traditionally not budged on union stuff, nothing's changed. Now, things have changed in the last few months because Ed Miliband has said about the changes that he wants to push through to the automatic union affiliation. But it seems like the government is still going to try and push some more stuff through anyway. And I think it's pretty hard to argue with Denham's comments, really. I think if this coalition breaks the kind of informal agreement that no party in power will legislate to disadvantage the other one in that respect, then I think it's open season. If Labour get in, they can basically do what they want, and the opposition of the time can't really argue at that point.
Well,
yeah, do you agree with that?
Well, I think to be honest, the legislation's drafted so badly, it wouldn't affect anyone particularly who can afford lawyers and can get around it. So I wouldn't worry too much about bigger unions. I think it's more of an issue for sort of, should we say, non-political charities being dragged into it being defined under politics when they shouldn't be, or shall we say, even small but successful local pressure groups such as No to H2 being dragged in. And I think that's where the real risk is. I mean, one of the crazy things about this lobbying bill as well is from what I can see from looking at it, I can spend millions and millions of pounds on negative campaigning, but only £5,000 on positive campaigning, which is another sort of terrible way that it's being done.
Oh, so we can have all the Swift boating we like?
Yes, indeed. No. It's essentially, it seems to be promoting a negative campaign.
Mm. Well, I think the interesting thing is going to be what happens when this comes back from committee stage, because I think it's still a bit kind of hanging out there at the moment. But once it comes back and then we're down to the substantive bill that's going to be voted upon, and I very much hope that it's substantially changed. And if it isn't, I would hope that my party will do something about it. But, you know, let's see.
OK, well, that was the sort of first bit of contentious parliamentary action that happened this week. There was also a report from the National Audit Office. I can't quote it exactly, but it said something like universal credit is complete bloody disaster. What the hell are you doing? Stop it now. Stop it now. Please, God, stop it now.
You should write executive summaries for a living, Emma.
I do write executive summaries for a living.
Well, there you go then.
but so I think, and then Ian Duncan Smith was called to Parliament to answer the questions that the report raised, to which he went, what, la, 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 no nonsense, nothing's happening, it's all going to come in. It will come in time and under budget. Now, I thought lying to Parliament was against the rules. Doug, can he really believe that? Nick?
Well, when I saw the news this week, I did think that you'd have a bout of IDS syndrome. I remember last time I came on here, we had a long conversation about evidence of conviction politicians, and he was an example you used. Well, I suppose what I would say is that the benefit system, big mess, a lot of money being spent on it, something needs to be done. Now, Ian Duncan Smith obviously spent a lot of time outside, shall we say, the confines of party politics, setting up his think tank, looking into it. And when Conservatives got in, they said to him, right, we need to do something about this. Your ideas are good. Go for it. Now, what's interesting about this is he's basically blaming the civil service for any mess that's been caused, and saying that essentially he's dealt with the problem of 14 people who can deal with this. And one thing, I mean, obviously I don't know the answer because I don't know what's been going on internally, but I will say one of the probably most complicated, biggest things that's happening in government at the moment, and the DWP aren't normally used to doing such work, so maybe there was a skills gap there. That he's been sorted. But I mean, you know, I mean, I suppose it shows you the importance of the organisations such as the NAO looking into this. And I suppose if that gives you confidence that problems are being found as long as they're being resolved, then as long as what happens in the end is okay, people will forget about this report.
But I'm not entirely clear that the government are listening to what the NAO have said and taking that on board. It just seems to be full steam ahead. We don't believe that's true, rather than we accept what you're saying.
I think he said the NAO report was right, but that was a lot of it was down to a lack of ability within the department to actually manage this and do this properly. And consultants have been brought in and things have been changed and these issues have been dealt with. I think that's what he said.
I think but it did seem to be very best case scenario management rather than here's the range of where we are. It was, you know, it's definitely going to come in at the absolute best possible way that it could do.
I mean, a lot of people concentrate on education because that's more visible straight away just with free schools coming in. But this is also going to be one of the big, big things that the government's going to be judged on. And
I agree.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, the government all the way to the top do know this. So they are focused. I think they are focused on this. I mean, what was very interesting was at the last reshuffle, Cameron originally wanted to shift IDS over and take him away from this job because obviously having somebody with the sort of passion was very, very good. But he wanted to put Chris Grayling in, who's somebody who ideologically is not as passionate, but definitely has a good reputation in terms of managing projects. But in the end, because of politics or I don't know what, they didn't do that in the end. So I think Cameron is watching this closely and he knows it's important for the future reputation of the government.
Yeah. Mark, what are your feelings?
I have quite a lot of feelings about this. I mean, we talked about universal credit quite a lot before, and I have always said that it's one of these things that I think in principle is a good idea, and I suspect is inevitable. I think in 10 or 20 years' time, at some point, we will have some system like this. But I think the ideological fervour with which IDS and some of his supporters have pushed this, I think is what has been its fatal flaw. I think, first of all, setting deadlines to political timetables for something that is so, so complicated. If you think about what they're trying to do here, they're trying to take six already highly complex systems and combine them into one system. And we know that government has a terrible record. I mean, government, you know, with a small g, you know, regardless of which party's in power, just the government machinery just isn't good at coping with stuff like this. And I think that's been exacerbated. If I heard correctly, apparently the actual civil servant in charge of the project has changed four times in the last 3 years. And I think the deputy has been changed four times in the last 3 years as well. So that's like a massive turnover at the highest levels of this project. And having worked on lots of computer projects in my time, I know how chaotic it can be if the personnel at the top keep changing. So that is a very, very bad sign. I think the way that IDS responded to the report isn't a good sign either. And it may have been that he made some comments about going, you know, that maybe went a little bit with the grain of the report. But certainly all the reporting that I've seen is that he basically disagreed with it. And I don't think you can you know, if an independent body comes up with a report like this, it really should be taken seriously. You've got to remember that these reports are written in kind of diplomatic speak. But actually, when you read what's in this report, it's about as coruscating as you can get for one of these reports. You know, it's basically saying that this thing is a complete shambles. And another aspect of this that worries me is that I'm starting to get the feeling that his department is being run the way he ran his leader's office when he was the leader of the Conservative Party between 2001 and 2003. And we know how that ended. I think that there is a...
Well, it ended quite quickly, didn't it?
Yes. Yes, and the decision was taken out of his hands. And I think there's a level of dysfunction in his office that I think we've seen before and we're seeing it again now. And I think Cameron should have replaced him when he did his reshuffle recently. I think Grayling would have been... I'm no fan of Chris Grayling, but I definitely think someone with a stronger grip on the tiller would have been a better thing for the project. Mm. I wonder whether... This might be a future lesson for future leaders of the opposition and future prime ministers, in that putting someone in a key position who is a former leader of the party is a risk. Because the reason why Cameron didn't move him is because he had too much respect for the fact that IDS was previously a leader of the party. And I don't believe that
because I think IDS's time as leader was generally accepted to be a complete failure. And he doesn't exactly have a massive swell of people, sort of like William Hague, maybe, who think he's hard done by. I think the reason why Cameron didn't move him is because of the conviction he has for this vision, and because he can. But what happened is he wasn't even in the shadow cabinet, and as soon as the government was formed, they said, right, you can have this department to make what you've said happen. Now, Cameron, in a way, put a lot of his own personal credibility behind putting the Centre of Social Justice vision forward. Now, for him to move IDS, he didn't want him to go to the back benches and completely resign and just go away from politics and then sort of start chucking in stuff from the side again. He wanted to take another job so it could all be done nice and neatly. But when IDS actually said, no, it's this or nothing, this is what I want to do in politics, he didn't have the guts, but he didn't think it was the right decision to change him.
But Cameron's political antennae must be quivering like mad about this, because he must be able to see and sense that if this thing is rolled out in any significant way, the problems, the potential catastrophe that just awaits if this goes wrong, because we're talking about real people. We're talking about real people's pensions and benefits and, people will be not being able to buy food and not being able to put the heating on. You know, this is real people. And what you just said earlier on, Nick, about, how you think that the government is still strongly committed to this. I wonder whether that's true, because they've pushed the delivery date now out to 2017 for this to be rolled out properly. Well, that's way beyond the next election. And at the moment, we've got 1,000 people on a pilot scheme, 1,000 people, all of whom don't have any children. Basically, the easiest base cases you can get in this kind of scenario.
I don't know. I disagree with that, because you can't have it both ways. I mean, if you're doing a very complex project and something that's never been done before, it's acceptable for time frames to shift. And earlier you said the time frames were due to political deadlines. Now you're saying the time frames got nothing to do with political deadline. I think pushing the time frame back is fine. I mean, I agree.
I would disagree that it's fine, Nick, because there were a lot of benefit changes that came in that people were disadvantaged by, but were told that will be sorted out, that your loss of money will be sorted out when universal credit comes in. So there are people who are going to have a much longer gap between when they get what they should be getting and what they're getting now.
I don't know so much about the detail of this. I mean, in general, when you're doing big complex projects, I think it's okay to push timelines out and adapt when issues happen. I will definitely say that, again, I'll go back to what I say, I think the government do know this is a very, very important thing. And I think they are right at the top watching it closely. And I certainly don't think they're letting it go at all.
Can I just respond quickly, Nick? So you pointed out a slight inconsistency in what I said, and that's a fair point. I did make the criticism about political deadlines, and then I have said about pushing it out. But I think the difference here is that, I mean, I've worked on lots of projects where timescales have been adhered to, and I've worked on lots of projects where timescales have had to slip. If timescales have to slip, they have to slip. You know, for the good of the project, sometimes that's what has to happen. But I think the difference here is this is politics, and pushing it to 2017 means it's pushed beyond the next general election. And I just think the wind has completely come out of the sails here. Where is the impetus going to be to get this sorted? The focus is going to be in all kinds of other places. I think what we've seen happen now means that this project is dead. I don't think that this is going to work, at least not in this way.
It can't be dead, can it? Because the current limbo can't continue, can it?
Well, because the next election's 20 months away now.
Yeah, no, I know, but it's just the current situation. We're in this middle limbo, aren't we? So it has to go somewhere, even if it goes back.
Mm. Yeah, well, I don't know exactly how they're going to get out of it, but you know, we could easily have a new government in place that doesn't really have, you know, an ideological commitment to this sort of change, with loads of other priorities coming in after 2015. So,
Emma, what do you think Labour would do if they got in with this?
I remember having a conversation quite early on in this government with a Labour minister who said to me, the Labour shadow minister, who said, you know, we're not against universal credit in principle. In principle, it's, you know, a perfectly sensible idea. It's just that nobody, and, you know, it had been pitched by the civil service to Labour when they were in charge for several times, and no one could see how it would actually work. And if we can't be convinced that it can work, we'd have to kill it. Because it's, you know, if you can't make it work, you can't make it happen.
Can I just say one last thing on this? And that is that we can't carry on with situations where governments just can't implement large, complex IT systems. We're going to have to get to a point where governments can do this sort of thing. I mean, we've seen disaster after disaster in this area, but I don't think it's good enough to just shrug your shoulders and say, yeah, government can't do this. Because this is the wave of the future. You know, computers aren't going anywhere. Computers are more and more integral to our lives. All private companies use them massively in all of their operations. We have to make sure that government can do this. And I don't really know what the answer is, but I don't think we can just sit on our hands about this. And I don't think whoever's in opposition can just laugh at whoever's in government. And then it all, you know, then it flips around in 2 or 3 years' time, and then the boot's on the other foot and the same thing happens again. I wonder if we need some kind of fundamental, you know, root and branch reform of how government does this stuff.
GCSE Prince 2, maybe?
Sorry?
Prince 2 for everyone. Because I think it was in the mid-late 90s or early 2000s, Prince 2, which is a project management system brought in by government in order to sort of make people understand how to do big projects, which obviously didn't work. And I think they've set up recently a major projects unit to monitor major projects, but obviously there's questions whether that's working well as well.
Yeah, maybe.
And you're right, we need to change how we do it, but I don't think that a project like this should be the test bed of that.
No, I agree. You need to do it in a kind of stepwise fashion and build slowly up to it.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think once again we've got to a point where we all know what we think of the universal credit situation we find ourselves in. We'll see what IDS, whether he listens to the NAO, whether the NAO continue to be right. Are right, if you prefer, and lots of people's lives will presumably be affected one way or the other. And I hope, for their sake, something happens to either make this miraculously work or the government just accept that they can't do it. Another big story this week was rolled out at 5 o'clock on Friday, the time then people obviously wanted to make sure that it was a big hit in the media and the press and that everyone was really clear on what was happening, was a statement released by the Labour Party saying that there had been no wrongdoing in Falkirk and the reinstatement of the members who had been suspended from the Labour Party. The statement that there had been no wrongdoing by any individual or organisation, alongside the statement from the former candidate, Kerry Murphy, I think it is. Probably should know that.
It is Kerry Murphy.
Thank God. that she would not be seeking the selection for the Falkirk seat. Obviously, this has led to a lot of speculation. The Labour Party still hasn't released the report into Falkirk, so we will never know, perhaps, what was contained in it. But it seems that some of the evidence has now been withdrawn.
By the way, when I read that some of the evidence has been withdrawn, I heard legs snapping in my mind.
Really? I can't imagine why next. yeah, and it, obviously the eve of TUC conference, which started today, I think. So it's obviously very good timing. Labour are once again causing themselves headaches over their relationships with the unions, despite Ed Miliband has said he wishes to continue with the reforms that he's proposed, despite there being probably led by events in Falkirk. Certainly the timing of them was led by events in Falkirk. And at the same time, we've also learnt this weekend that Sarah Tether, the Liberal Democrat MP, has announced that she will not be a Liberal Democrat or MP after the next election. I'm unclear as to whether she's resigned from the party now or whether she'll continue to take the party whip, Mark. Do you know?
I think she's going to continue to take the party whip. I've not heard that she's not, but I suspect this is a fairly fluid situation and who knows where she'll be in a week's time. But at the moment, I believe she's still Lib Dem.
Okay. I mean, it struck me that these two issues, whilst we can and will discuss them separately, do have something in common in that it seems to be the catalyst of the fallout has been the relationship between the powerful within a party and the membership. And certainly Sarah Tether seems to be very clear that she doesn't feel she is the powerful within her party and that her party is being led in the wrong direction. And I think that there are certain Labour Party members who would say the same thing one way or the other about Falkirk, whether you're on the left and believe that, you know, the unions have been completely vindicated, or whether you're on the right and probably agree with Nick that there was a certain amount of pressure brought to bear to ensure this situation. One way or the other, it is about the difference between the political leadership and the political members. Would you say that was fair, Mark?
Yeah, who knows what's happened in Falkirk? There is, as Nick rightly alluded to, an element of, where's your evidence, the new? You know, that's my best Scottish accent. You hear this phrase, don't you, machine politics. And that was what kept cropping up when the Falkirk thing broke originally. And this stinks of machine politics as well. The fact that there's a report that's not being released and the evidence has been withdrawn. And everything's all fine again. And what was the fuss about? There was nothing to see here. Move along. There's something fishy going on, but maybe we'll just never get to the bottom of it. I mean, I'm wondering why Carrie Murphy's withdrawn. It's completely fair enough that she has. If I was her, I'd be just thinking, I've had enough of this. They can piss off. And maybe that's what it is. But, you know, that just seems a bit strange as well. If there was no problem, you know, wouldn't she want to carry on?
To carry on my cynicism, we'll find out if she ends up in a safe seat somewhere else before 2015.
That's a good point, actually. Yeah.
I suspect that's not the deal that was done. I think that she will have a good job somewhere else.
Okay. But we're in a fascinating position now, aren't we? Because the original Falkirk scandal, in quotes, which now appears to not have been a scandal, kicked off this process that is probably going to lead to a very large scale reorganisation of how one of our two major political parties is funded and operates.
Indeed.
And yet, there really seemed to have been no reason for that process to have kicked off. Well, no, let's be honest. Something like this has probably been coming downstream for a long time. And this was just the straw that broke the camel's back. It just so happens that this straw wasn't the straw. But yes, so we're in a kind of slightly weird Alice through the looking glass scenario with this now. I'm just frustrated that we're not going to find out what was in this report, because the next time Labour start criticising one of the other parties for not releasing some information, they'll just be on a hide into nothing, because that will just seem like complete hypocrisy. You know, imagine if the Morrissey report that the Lib Dems commissioned a few months ago, if that had been kept secret, for example. You know, it's not on having these secret reports that only a few key people get to see. If there's corruption going on or dodgy things going on, you know, people need to know.
Well, as I understand it, the justification is that witnesses were giving evidence in a way that they were told would be safe. And these are people whose jobs might have been compromised if they were seen to be, corroborating certain allegations.
Well, there's ways of anonymising things, and that was done in the Morrissey.
But, I mean, I agree with you. I think the report should have been made public. I've said that. I think Labour Party members deserve to know why. I agree that Falkirk was the catalyst for what Ed Miliband has done in terms of re-looking at union membership and union funding to the Labour Party. I think he did the right thing, though. So I'm still backing those changes and what we hope will come out of the Collins review, which presumably will be published publicly.
I mean, if I was a conspiracy theorist, I might be sitting here saying it's it's all just a bit convenient, isn't it? Maybe, you know, there was something going on behind the scenes that, you know, engineered something so that he then had his chance to have his Clause 4 moment. But then actually nothing happened, and now there's not even a scandal. And when people look back, they can say, well, no, there was nothing wrong there, but it's given him the opportunity to do what he needed to do. I actually don't think that's right, but it wouldn't at all surprise me if some people out there do believe that, because it all just seems very strange.
I think some who disagree with the proposed changes would certainly say that. I don't think that's what happened.
I mean, I think looking from an outsider's point of view, in terms of the Falkirk issue, I think the real great shame of this is that the really sort of radical solution has not been followed. And that, for me, that would be having an open primary to pick the Labour candidate for Falkirk. Over the last six elections, over 50% of people in Falkirk have voted for a Labour candidate. Falkirk, as an area, always wants Labour government and Labour MP. So the people of Falkirk themselves should pick who this person is.
I mean, I'm completely apathetic on primaries. I'm not against them. I'm not for them. I'm not sure they're the answer to deeper institutional problems that all political parties have. But it certainly would have been an opportunity to trial that. But it seems that they're just reopening the traditional
Labour. Labour have nothing to lose from an open primary, because they'll get a Labour candidate, and Labour candidate will be elected. But actually, it will clear away all this sort of, you know, is there corruption going on? Are people being put in? Because actually, it'll be an open process. But I mean, that's what I take from this. Looking at it from an outsider, I think it's a shame that Ed Miliband hasn't embraced this issue in this way. Rather, I mean, the union funding thing is another matter. I think, you know, there are issues there, but I think this was the real sort of radical open way to change how politics is done in the UK.
But to be fair, though, Nick, if he's in a situation, Ed Miliband, where he's taken some decisions that are probably going to restrict, to some extent, perhaps quite massively, how much money the Labour Party have, and to then suddenly take a decision that's going to mean, if that was rolled out across every constituency in the country, would probably cost tens of thousands of pounds in each and every one. I just don't think that's realistic, and that's always the sticking point with open primaries, just how much they cost to do them properly.
And we have actually said we're going to have a primary for the London mayoral candidate, I believe.
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, that is part of the mix. It's just not part of the Falkirk mix.
No. I think it would have been symbolically very great if Ed Miliband had done that. But, you know, that's how I looked at it. I mean, on the union stuff, I think it's a very interesting question for you guys, because for Emma and Labour rights, because obviously the unions are an important part of the Labour Party, and I say that not as a criticism in any way. So, you know, unions are part of society, and they're part of the Labour movement, and that's completely fine. But the problem with any sort of political party is when one part of it gets too much power, and what's bad about that is basically wrong decisions can get made. There isn't wider thought and about what the wider country would need. And I wonder if Ed Miliband was annoyed or by this sort of, by the unions maybe having more power than they should have at the moment, because they're less membership from elsewhere, and he sort of put two and two together and then thought, yes, I could do something brilliant, here's my Clause 4 moment. But then a few months later realised that actually this is very complicated and dangerous to Labour, and this is why he's sort of starting to roll back from it now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much we're going to roll back on the wider reforms. We'll have to see what comes out of the Collins report, which will make the recommendations. And Ed said he still wants to go ahead with these reforms. So we'll see whether he can get them through the party. I'm very proud to be a member of a union, and I'm very proud that Labour have a union link. But I think we should be honest about how that link works and what it is. And I'm very much in favour of widening that link with union members, which might dilute the power of union leaders, but would actually do more to bring in the wider voices of the union movement, which I think is a really important thing for Labour.
Well, that's an interesting point, Emma, and it kind of tallies with something I've been mulling over in the last few days, because I was listening to another political podcast. I listen to quite a lot of them. They do exist.
this one, obviously.
No, none of them are as good as this, of course. I think it was the Guardian one that I was listening to, and they were talking there just about unions and about this whole issue. But they were saying about how union membership has fallen quite dramatically in the last few decades. And the more I was thinking about it, as I was walking my dog around the lake, I was just thinking, I've been in work for 18 years now. In fact, it's going to be 18 years in 10 days' time that we'll be to the day. I've never, in any of the companies I've ever worked for, been approached by a union, you know, someone from a union to say, do you want to come and join this union? Now, I don't work in a job that I guess you would particularly associate with unions. I'm a software developer. But there are hundreds of thousands, probably millions of software developers in this country in various guises, and lots of other jobs that, although they're not exactly the same as that, would probably fall into a similar kind of white-collar category. Mm. And I just wonder how many of these millions, perhaps tens of millions of people working in some of these jobs have never been approached by a union. And I wonder if it's not just the Labour Party that needs to reform. The unions themselves, if they're gonna work in the 21st century properly, I think they're going to have to change the way they operate.
I completely agree. We need to be far, far... The union movement needs to be far better at reaching out to the private sector. It needs to be far better at reaching out to small businesses. It needs to make its offer more attractive to people working in small businesses. And it needs to be more flexible. My concern is that the unions have amalgamated so much that they are, certainly the big ones, are quite far removed from you know, having the kind of relationship that we had with workplaces in the past.
I think this is part of Labour's problem, isn't it, as well? Because in previously, when you had the, obviously unions have always been a strong voice, but you had a variety of strong voices. Even on this, when Tony Blair was leaving, I remember you had a variety of different union leaders across the from centre-left to far-left spectrum. But now there seems to be maybe two or three big voices.
Yeah, I mean, there are still lots and lots of unions. Not all of them are affiliated to Labour Party, and some of them are, and some of them are bigger and some of them are smaller. But
there are 149 unions, apparently. I was looking at this today. So that's how many there are now. I don't know how many there used to be. Doesn't seem like that many. And I think that's a function of these kind of amalgamations that you're talking about. You've got several behemoth unions and then loads of little minnows swimming around, you know, around them.
And I think what I would like to see is much more strengthening of the relationship with smaller unions and strengthening of their role in public life, because I think that they quite often are, particularly those that represent one specific strand of work or something, a bit closer to the workforce. So I think they have probably more of a closer understanding, more likely to have their officers having been people who've worked up from the workforce rather than people who have come into the union through their political belief in unionism rather than worked up from representation, if you see what I mean. I agree that the union movement is not perfect and needs to change to better develop representation in the 21st century. I think having a union movement is incredibly important. You see that in all sorts of international data, which shows that, you know, places with strong unions have better economies, as well as better quality of life for workers, you know, much more likely to be politically freer. You know, it's a very important movement. So we need to make sure that we are looking after that movement and making sure that movement is the best movement it can be.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think that would make the unions stronger in general is actually if they did step away from the Labour Party and were basically a purely sort of lobbying campaigning group. Because obviously for someone like myself, who's a member of the Tory Party, you know, I don't feel that the unions are particularly friendly towards me, and I feel that they're very political and blindly so towards one section. I think that probably dampens their ability to actually represent a wider audience and lobby on wider issues.
I don't want to see the unions step away from the Labour Party. I want to change the way that we interact with the unions and make sure that those union members who are interested in being involved with the Labour Party have a good and coherent route to do so.
So can you? Are unions only for Labour supporters then?
No, absolutely not. I know Conservative unionists, I know Lib Dem unionists. Not every union is affiliated to the Labour Party for a start. So, you know, if you are a civil servant, you might likely to be a member of the PCS and they're not affiliated to the Labour Party.
Not affiliated to anyone, are they, though?
I don't think so, no.
They'd have to be independent, wouldn't they? I think. But anyway, I suppose I think you're right, but obviously the biggest ones the biggest ones tend to be associated with Labour Party, and the loudest, smallest ones tend to be associated with the, shall we say, even more left-wing parties like Bob Crowe's lot and the People's Assembly. I like unions in general. I think they are important in society, but I just don't... The movement is so politically associated with Labour, I think that cuts off their ability to sort of represent me.
And I think I agree with Nick's point there, really, Emma, because, you know, perhaps one of the reasons why I haven't been so proactive in seeking out unions is because kind of in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, well, yeah, but that's Labour and I'm not really, you know what I mean? And I imagine there are a lot of people who probably feel the same way, that they kind of think, well, but if I get involved with you, isn't that Labour? They are so inextricably linked with each other. And I think that reform thing I was talking about earlier on, I think some kind of decoupling of the unions from the Labour Party in the long term, I think is going to have to happen if they're going to become relevant to the lives of people across the entire country. You think about how many people...
I disagree. I think the three of us are thinking like tribalists. You wouldn't go for something Labour because you're very firmly connected to your party. I think that the 99% of the country who aren't members of the political party probably don't think that way necessarily, and would join an organisation that might be affiliated to the Labour Party but also does great stuff in their workplace. It's about offering that great stuff in the workplace.
Well, I mean, I think as Mark raised at the beginning, there's a coincidence or a link between not joining political parties and less people joining unions.
There may be, there may not be. There are plenty of people join other pressure groups. You know, the RSPB has a million members.
Yeah, no, but the RSPB isn't overly politicised, is it? You know, I think people can join the RSPB and they're not making a statement about their political beliefs. I think if people join a union, they might not be doing that, but they might feel like they are, and other people might think that they are.
Some people might feel that. I think people who might feel that are people who are thinking politically. I think the three of us think politically. I don't think lots of other people do.
I think you're being a bit dismissive of something that's probably a bit broader. You've got to remember, Emma, I only joined the Lib Dems 5 years ago, and I've kind of had this feeling ever since I first started work, really. And that was, like I said, 18 years ago. So, you know, I mean, we've had endless arguments about what is tribalism and what isn't, and let's not go over those again. But, you know, I think this is a bit broader than you're accepting here.
We'll just have to agree to disagree. I think I know members of unions who are Conservative. I know members of unions who are Liberal Democrats. I know members of unions who are Greens. I know members of unions who are on the far left who wouldn't dream of joining Labour Party. They, you know, the link between Labour and the unions is because Labour was set up by the unions.
Yeah, but I don't think it's serving either of them very well anymore.
It's not under the current circumstances, but that's not to say that you have to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
I think we are going to have to agree to disagree. Maybe we'll come back to this another time.
But coming back to our original question. So, we've talked about Falkirk, but has Sarah just come to the end of her tether?
I was going to say that.
I have been waiting for that. Joy being the host, Mark. I get to say it first.
I'll come in on this, because the wider point that I take from this is when Lib Dems entered government in 2010 as part of the coalition, I loved it. I didn't just love it because I'm a Liberal Tory and I think, you know, Lib Dems do have a lot to offer. And I like the fact I'd rather have Lib Dem MPs, David Laws than Peter Bone, really, in my political party. But I also, because a lot of my friends who voted Lib Dems were sort of chickening out and not taking real decisions. They were voting for the safe sort of option without having to make a real decision. So I love the fact that many of them were mortified the day after the election when the Lib Dems became coalition parties with the Conservatives and realised they'd actually voted to prop up a Conservative government. I just said to them, well, what do you think you're voting for?
So, yeah,
you know, and this Sarah Tether thing, I think, is sort of, it reminds me all of that, because in her interview, she said, my proudest moment in government was when Nick Clegg announced that we were ending the routine detention of children in the immigration system. That's brilliant. That's what happens when you're in government. You can do stuff like that. But the other thing that happens in government, especially if you're the minority party, and, you know, the Lib Dems, obviously, you know, they are the third party, no matter how popular they are nowadays or not so popular. But you know, you can't get everything your own way. So I think she's basically having a tussle with what being a responsible politician is all about.
I think we might be the fourth party, actually, Nick. But anyway, I'll just say that before Emma does.
Yeah, well, I think MP-wise, you'll be the third party.
Yeah, I think
that. Okay, well, I suppose I should say some words, shouldn't I? Okay. I mean,
we should have set up the Is Sarah Tether Still a Lib Dem website, Mark?
Yeah, well, yeah, like I said, I think she is at the moment, but she's obviously very, very unhappy. And, you know, okay, so I don't think it's a good thing when someone says the sort of things that she's said about her own party, you know, one of our own MPs, but I think she is being honest about what she thinks. I think it's clear when she was a minister, she found the process quite excruciating. from what she said in her interview. And I think we knew that anyway, really, from things she said since she lost a ministerial position. And, you know, I think she's done the right thing for her. You know, on a personal level, she obviously isn't happy with the political situation, and she's decided that she doesn't want to do it anymore. And, you know, I mean, she's been active in politics for 20 years, and, you know, maybe that's long enough. Maybe other politicians should take note, and, you know, after they've been in the game for that long, maybe they should think about taking a break from it as well. In terms of the wider political questions that this throws up, you know, of course, being in government is difficult. You know, there are things that this government has done that I've been very unhappy with. You know, we talked about secret courts. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, Emma, and you were kind of, you know, prodding me about what would it take for you to leave the party. I mean, I think we've seen in Sarah Tether's case what it's taken for her to at the very least stand down as an MP. You know, she's had enough. I think the straw that broke the camel's back was this thing about the £1,000 immigrant bond or something that Nick Clegg floated. That seemed to be a particular bone of contention for her. It's probably just worth mentioning as well, because I know there are a lot of Lib Dem activists who were very, very pissed off with Sarah Tether about how she voted on equal marriage, and also the statement that she put out on her website, which seemed to me to be pretty incoherent, really. I mean, she was talking about how equal marriage could make family life more unstable and the civil partnerships are good enough. And it seemed to be all over the place, really reading between the lines. It seemed to be her trying to reconcile her Catholicism, or at least how she interprets her Catholicism, with her liberalism. And it seemed to be that the, you know, the authoritarian side was winning in that respect. But she had a very, very tough fight in Brent Central. You know, make no bones about it. She was really up against it. And I think quite a lot of the activists who previously helped her out were just going to go nowhere near helping her out this time round. So I wonder if there's an element of pragmatism here, in that perhaps she thought maybe she wasn't going to win in 2015 anyway, and she's decided to stand down for those reasons. It's at least worth considering that that might be a factor.
I'm sure it was. I mean, yeah, she is. And I think she's slightly, reminds me of Claire Short in a way, very much having her cake and eating it. So, yeah, I hate all these terrible things that I've voted for. you know, it's very self-important, and she's not the most widely respected of politicians from other parties, although I believe she's fairly well respected within the Lib Dems.
Yes, in some respect, yeah. Well, she's been very, very good on things like immigration, for example. You know, she's been a tireless campaigner. She even, I'm sure she didn't do it single-handedly, but I believe she was instrumental in getting one of her constituents released from Guantanamo Bay, for example. You know, and there are big achievements that she's managed. She also steered through the pupil premium, which I know a lot of Lib Dems think is a very good thing, you know, when she was a minister. So, you know, it's not... There's things on both sides of the balance sheet here, and we should be honest about that.
I mean, I think in some ways it's as Mark said, in terms of, you know, the likelihood of winning, maintaining the seat after the next election is very minimal anyway. So it sort of takes away the in some ways sort of importance of this story. I don't know her as well as Mark, but it does seem to me somebody who sort of thought, well, I've trodden this path and I've gone as far as I can in this position, and there's no point in me staying any longer. So, and I think, you know, she should be commended for making that decision and stepping down.
I think the Labour MP stroke minister that this actually reminds me of probably more than Claire Short is Estelle Morris, actually. When she stood down as a minister, I mean, obviously Sarah Tether didn't stand down, she was fired. You know, and actually she was shifted out to shoehorn David Laws in, which I'm sure pissed her off no end. But Estelle Morris, when she made those comments about she just in the end didn't quite feel she was up to it. I don't think Sarah Tether's saying she didn't feel she was up to it, but it almost feels like there are just too many compromises in government for her, and her own political philosophy is not compatible with it, and she's just had enough and she's stepping down. I think it's analogous to the position Estelle Morris found herself in.
Mark, can I ask you a question, actually? Mm. Because something that being Conservative, you know, it's difficult for me to understand, is obviously because Lib Dems, seat-wise, are going to be the third party, and their ambition is to be the constant centre in force of government, always in coalition. So if we look back in future, almost like a Thatcher-like Blair type of situation. Now, that obviously means compromising. It obviously means going to government with people you disagree with. It obviously means sometimes having policies that you disagree with as well. I mean, how do you draw the... Where do you draw the line? How do you deal with that? What, you know...
Can you get an answer out of them after that?
I come from a political tribe which is used to, and we want to get it all, and we'll do it all, even if it's, you know, it's wrong or right. How do you sort of deal with that?
Yeah, well, I suppose I can try and answer that question in a way, which is that I think we as a country, and certainly we as a party, and maybe all the parties, need to get better at doing coalitions. If you think about what happened in the run-up to the 2010 election, although the polls were saying that there was a pretty good chance there would be a hung parliament, I don't think anyone really believed it was going to happen until it actually happened. I think everyone thought, nah, but, you know, in the end, one party or the other always gets over the finish line, even if it's only a small majority. But in the end, it did happen. And it happened in a way that actually there really had to be a full-blooded coalition. You know, the confidence and supply thing I just don't think would have worked for various reasons. But since the coalition was formed, I think there have been all kinds of problems. And I think some of them have been caused by the fact that we're just not used to coalitions, and the way the manifestos are drafted and the way the election campaigns are run. It's all about we will do this, we will do that. And actually, you know, in this betrayal narrative that the Lib Dems have been battered over and over again, you know, betray this, betray that, and tuition fees and NHS and this, that and the other. And, you know, in some ways, they're very fair criticisms. You know, we said we wouldn't do certain things and we've done them, you know, and that does not look good. And it's very, very difficult to defend. But that's because of the way that we run our politics. You know, MPs and party leaders get out there and they say, we are going to do this and we are not going to do that. And, you know, I wonder if in years to come, maybe once we've had two or three of these coalitions, say in the next 20 or 30 years, that it will be different because people will expect it more. You know, I probably need to spend more time studying and reflecting upon how coalitions work in other countries, because other countries seem to make them work without tearing themselves apart in the way that, you know, there seems to be a risk that we're going to do here. I mean, in terms of, you know, what would be the compromise too far that would cause me to leave the party, the truth is I honestly don't know. I'm not there yet. And, you know, I think there a lot of good that the party's done. But, you know, there's a lot of things that this government's done I'm not happy with either.
I know, but in some ways you're saying that the fact that this should be the general way things should work, there'll be very little that make you leave because you believe this is the way things should work.
Well, I think, yeah.
That's what you're saying.
That's, yeah.
Which is fine, as a position. I mean,
in a way, I think you're right to an extent. The truth is, when it came to secret courts, I actually came bloody close to leaving. Mm. That is the truth. In the end, I didn't. But you're right that if you're a Lib Dem, at your core, you have to kind of believe in compromise, really, because really, we know that we're not going to be in government in our own right. I mean, that just isn't going to happen. So the only way we're going to have any real power and influence is to compromise with another party. The question then comes down to, what do you compromise on? How do you structure that? How do you deal with the compromises? And how do you then sell what you've done to the electorate? And those are the bits that I don't think we're getting right at the moment. And, you know, it will be very telling in 2015. You know, maybe there's some secret, you know, secret pieces of paper in some locked drawer somewhere in Nick Clegg's office about how we're going to win, how we're going to do really well in the 2015 election and reconcile all of these things. I suspect those pieces of paper don't exist. And, you know, we're kind of winging it at the moment and we're just going to have to see how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Lib Dems will do as badly as some people think they'll do. I don't think you're going to be wiped out. But I do think you'll lose a considerable amount of seats. And I think that the question will be, for yourselves as a party, are you there to represent the people who want to vote for liberal values, or are you there to represent the people who want to vote for compromise?
Yeah, well, there's an interesting debate going on within the party at the moment, because there are signs that the kind of policies that we're starting to draw up for 2015 are the kind of policies that will work in conjunction with one or other of the other parties. Mm. And there's actually quite a strong feeling within the grassroots that I'm picking up that we shouldn't be doing that. We should set out our own independent liberal stall as a separate party. And then depending on how the electoral cards fall, if we then need to compromise, then we need to compromise.
Do you remember those books that you used to get where, you know, you'd read the end of one page and it said, if you want your character to do X, go to page 15. If you want your character to do Y, And it's all, you almost see the manifesto like that. Is if the Conservatives get more seats, go to this page. If Labour win and get more seats, go to this page of our manifesto.
What I used to do with those Choose Your Own Adventure books, Nick, I don't know if this was widespread, is that the first time I made a choice, I'd keep my little finger in that page. And then when I got to the next choice, I'd keep my second finger. So in the end, I'd have like five fingers up. And then if something went wrong, I could backtrack and I could, you know, I could almost have like a little binary tree of decisions and actually get to something I was happy with.
Reading. You always Lib Dem.
I know that is the perfect analogy for Lib Dem.
Have we finally found it? There you go. I've always been a Lib. I thought it was just the last 5 years.
If you don't like this policy, I'll show you the other one.
Actually, just before we finish on this, because we've slightly moved off tether, but I think it is just worth noting, you know, she's one of our only seven female MPs, mm-hmm. and she's standing down. I mean, I hope the candidate she's replaced with is a woman, but there's no guarantee of that. It's, you know, it's worth just reflecting.
It'll be a Labour person who wins that seat anyway. So I think one of the things, linking this into Falkirk quickly, funnily enough, I think the Lib Dems have the most open and democratic selection process but to pick candidates, but then they have the worst stats on diversity.
Absolutely, and you know, they're not doing enough to change that.
To be fair, we've also had a couple of male MPs who've announced they're going to be standing down as well. I think Malcolm Bruce is one. I think there was another one as well a few weeks ago. So
Mike Hancock, is it?
Well, I imagine he probably will be, although I don't think he's announced that yet. But let's see what happens.
Okay, well, yes, it will be interesting to see which middle-aged white man they replace Sarah Teth with.
Okay. I think it's more likely she'll be replaced by a child of Tony Blair's cabinet member.
Yeah, but I think they've all got seats already.
No, well, maybe a minister then.
Blair hasn't got one yet, but you know, give it time.
Give it time. I don't know if Brent close enough to central London.
I'm a middle-aged white man.
There you go. You can go for it.
Yeah. If only I was on the approved candidate list, eh?
Ah, shame. Okay, well, I think we've had quite a long discussion today, covering quite a lot of interesting politics. For the first week back at term, it's been quite a dramatic one, and we're about to head into conference season. Is it next week, Glasgow, Mark?
Yes, it is, and I'm hoping to record a special one-off Lib Dem conference podcast. So that'll be me and probably a couple of other Lib Dems, still just trying to sort out the details for that. And then I think the week after, we're going to try and do one down in Labour conference, where I'm actually going to come down as well. So, because you're down in Brighton, aren't you, Emma?
We are indeed. And Nick, you're then off to Manchester, aren't you?
Yeah,
that
yeah,
bastion yeah. of conservatism.
Well, historically, I think it was a very strong conservative area around the time of the Industrial Revolution. So you know how we like to live in the past.
Yeah, well, I studied in Manchester in the early to mid 90s, Nick, and it wasn't a bastion of conservative thought then. Let's just put it that way.
That's it could be where she could be going to Liverpool.
Yeah. I wonder, when they have the fencing and the security guards, whether it's to keep the Mancunians away from us or our conservative ideas away from them.
Okay, well, thank you ever so much to Nick and Mark for joining me. Also, thank you to Audioboo for hosting and Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com for our theme music.
The future's been sung in really, really, really good.